12 years ago when I started this show, it was, you know, 1,000 people listening. Now it's 250,000 and all in's 1,000,000. You know, it's a lot of listeners. And I was getting my blood drawn because I'm on this health kick. And the phlebotomist came to the house and he's like halfway through taking 20 pints. And he's like, I just want to say, and I was like, fan of the pod. And he said, yeah. I said, you want to take a selfie? He said, I really do, but I get fired, whatever. And I said, let's do it. Don't tell your boss. Then I go to dinner the same night. And I'm like, I got to eat a chicken parm. I saw somebody had tweeted a chicken parm. So I go, I get a chicken parm, find the best one on Yelp. The waiter's like, I hate to do this. And I'm like, fan of the pod? Big time. I go to Berkeley or whatever. And I was like, okay, you want to take a selfie? He's like, yeah. I said, let's do it in the parking lot so you don't get fired. So we went to the back in the parking lot. I take a picture with him. It's very weird. It is very weird.
Well, congratulations. You should feel good. Yeah. You've been working at it a long time. So well done.
Yeah, you know, I think it's like... There's also something about like doing things, and I think it's a really good part of our conversation. Hey, everybody, welcome to This Week in Startup. Rich Barton is here. We're off to the races.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Crowdbotics. Great ideas can change the world. And Crowdbotics is the fastest way to turn those ideas into code. Get a free scoping session for your next big app idea at crowdbotics.com/twist. OpenPhone brings your team's business calls, texts, and contacts into one delightful app that works anywhere. Get 20% off your first 6 months at openphone.com/twist. And Fitbod. Tired of doing the same workouts at the gym? Fitbod will build you personalized workouts that help you progress with every set. Get 25% off your subscription or try out the app for free when you sign up now at fitbod.me/twist.
So Rich Barton is the, or was the founder of Expedia, Glassdoor, and now the CEO of Zillow. Been trying to get him on the program for a while, but he's like one of those quiet assassin executors. You're not like super into doing media, although you've had media at the core of a lot of your success in terms of strategies. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we have, you know, I believe that the product should speak for itself and it should be amplified by earned media and word of like good old word of mouth. I really believe that's the way the good stuff gets out there. So I'm certainly familiar with media, but I am relatively bashful. That won't be coming through in the pod, though, Jacob.
Well, I mean, we'll have a good time. You and I have a lot of friends in common and we're, you know, we're just chopping it up, talking shop. But I would like to just double click on this one immediately because I think you're being super humble. When I meet with startups and they ask me, hey, I want to do earned media. I want to earn some media. I don't want to just hire a PR firm. I want to have a strategy. And you know what the first thing I tell them to look at? Zillow and the Zestimate. Because I met your CMO. Remind me of her name.
Amy Butinsky. She's on our board now, but
Amy. And she spoke at a couple of my conferences. I interviewed her on this podcast, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. You came up with the ultimate earned media for Zillow. Maybe you could explain, because she's explained it to me, and I have some broad strokes here, but from your perspective as the founder, CEO of Zillow, maybe talk about how you created Zestimate. And then the local reports, which then let you literally take over every quarter on a rolling basis, the local news cycle for real estate, which is adult porn, basically.
All right. So there's a ton in there. Amy's just brilliant. There's a ton in there. And I could reach back and give a little context about how we got there. And then I'll tell you about it if you really want to get the story.
Yeah,
but it goes back to another bestie of the pod, Bill Gurley.
Bill Gurley
led our A round and is a good friend. And I was a venture partner at Benchmark for 17 years. So I'd done a bunch of stuff with Bill and those folks. And we were early as Zillow. We didn't even have the product quite down yet. This is in 2006. And I had just come off selling Expedia to Barry Diller. I had taken Expedia public when I was 32 years old. Back in 1999, even you remember that.
Yeah. Yep.
That was when, you know, dogfood.com could literally go public.
We'll get into the Expedia story. That's a fascinating one.
But I had taken Expedia public and I was used to spending advertising money. And as we were getting ready to launch Zillow, Gurley said, hey, Rich, what if you had a $0 ad budget, then what would you do? And I was like, okay, what would I do? I was like, that's impossible. Of course you can't do that. But like all BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals, you think at first it's impossible. Then you go away and think about it for a little while. And you start to shoot the stuff with your friends, have a couple beers and think about, well, how might we do that? And so we basically ended up taking this project that turned into Zillow and pivoted towards creation of the Zestimate, which most of your listeners and viewers out there know
everybody
what the Zestimate is.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody knows, but it was-
Everybody knows. You gave an estimate on the price of a home and you did that through looking at recent sales in the home and then whatever data you had on the home that you had licensed, if I understand correctly, you licensed a bunch of data.
Yep.
And it infuriated people because everybody believes that their house is worth 10% more than whatever the highest priced house that just sold is. And so then they all went to you and said, how dare you? I'm going to sue you. I'm upset. My house is worth $67,000 more than this. And then all of a sudden they know Zillow. They've logged in and claimed their home.
Yes. Yes. I would say I wouldn't be quite so negative on it and say, yeah, there was some negativity to it, but it was very provocative. So
it's
we used AI to create the original Zestimate long, long ago.
Yeah.
And we figured, oh, we'd drop this price on every house in the country. We'd update it every night and it would be provocative from a look up your old girlfriend's, from high school where she's living now, what that house is worth. We had a lot of that. We had a lot of, that's not right, just like you said. Yep. And we had a lot of, hey, I'm actually looking for a home right now and I want to know what the hell that thing's worth. And so it was this interesting intermingling of the kind of titillating and the pragmatic, which is a wonderful sweet spot to be if you're building consumer product. If you can really get emotionally involved with your customer, with the product, but also be super pragmatic at the same time, you're really digging in the right spot, in my opinion.
So there was some tension there, just to unpack that, because when you talk, I mean, I've listened to 3 or 4 of your interviews in preparation for this, and I listened to it candidly. I just respect you so much as an entrepreneur.
Thanks, dude.
I see, like, you're, along with Mark Knopfler and, like, some other topics on my YouTube, you come up often. So I see, like, 9-year-old interviews with you and Gurley or Gerstner or whatever. It's always great, but you got to double click on that one. There's some tension there.
Yeah.
And that tension means attention and importance, correct?
I like that. I've never heard it put that way, but exactly. If there's no tension, there's nothing interesting. Just like when you're telling a story, there has to be tension and that tension has to be released. And that's what a story is, right?
Mm. Did you ever study screenplay writing or think of being
I didn't, but I really do love, I love, like you do, I love movies and books. So,
who's your favorite director?
I think the Coen brothers. Coen brothers.
Oh,
I'm
really
dating myself, but like Raising Arizona. Oh my God. I used to drive back and forth to college across the country in my Honda Civic.
Nicolas Cage, right? I mean,
Nick Cage and Holly Hunter and John Goodman. It was, it's brilliant. Every line is brilliant. And so many of the Coen brothers movies are that way. Big Lebowski. I mean, like how many times can you watch Big Lebowski?
Repeatability, I think, is such an important characteristic. This is why Ridley Scott is, I think, my number one, Scorsese, Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
They always just clog up my top list and I can watch Gladiator or Goodfellas any moment. Minute one, minute 100, I'm watching till the end. I can't get turned off, can't change the channel.
Do you know Ridley Scott? Ridley Scott did the original Mac ad for Steve Jobs?
I didn't know that. I feel
it's
like
worth,
I did, but in
the 1984. 1984 will not be like 1984. That woman with the hammer throwing it through
Incredible.
Big Brother on the screen. It was like, that was important to me. I was watching, it was in the Super Bowl. It ran once, that ad.
I think
only
you're a little older than me. You were born 1968,
67? 67, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're 3 years older than me. So at that time, when it came out in 84, you were 17 years old. I was 14.
Yeah.
I had a PC Junior. What computer were you rocking at that time?
I went
Commodore
through the
64?
TRS.
What were you on?
There it is. I went through the TRS-80, the Commodore 64. And at the time, I probably had an Apple IIe. And this was the moment, right? The rise of IBM was biggest in the personal computer business.
Yes.
And this basically was supposed to represent all the mindless drones watching Big Brother's big head on the screen representing IBM. And this is Apple, Steve Jobs and the Mac, this woman, this athletic woman who is breaking the spell. Look at that.
It's so subversive when you think about it. You've got all these, I mean, on a gender basis, I didn't even consider the fact, knowing this iconic commercial, that it's a woman coming in running like an Olympian.
Yeah.
To knowing that she's outnumbered and she's just going to blow up the screen with the man on it and all these drones. It was so iconic and made you so enthused about the power of technology. It was an inspiring call for our generation, I believe.
The power to the people is kind of how I've retrofitted my whole company creation philosophy, that technology empowers the regular person to take on the man and bust the old ways. And like, this is what this ad did for me. And it has that very, you brought up Ridley Scott, it has that very Blade Runner-y, vibey, dark, apocalyptic, thing.
Well, man against the machine, right? And then the same thing with Gladiator, et cetera. So this tension also manifested itself in Glassdoor. Hey, what's it like to work at this place?
Yeah.
Rate your boss. And how much are you getting paid? It's a... another example of, there's going to be some people who are inspired and empowered by this data. There's going to be a lot of tension, as some people are going to want stuff fixed. Hey, this was unfair, yada, yada. But you cannot look away. You must engage.
That's right. That's right. That was how and why we launched Glassdoor. We had kind of this, you show me yours, I'll show you mine, give to get model for salary. So you can anonymously share your salary. And if you do, then you can see what everybody else is anonymized. Salaries are for this job, and wow, what a wonderful power to the people liberating data thing. You know, it kind of came from a printer accident I had. I was running Zillow at the time, and I accidentally printed everybody's review and salary and raises out in the common printer rather than my printer. Ooh, this is back when we actually had printers.
Yes. And IT nightmare.
Luckily, I caught it, but actually, it got me thinking. Well, what if everybody did see it?
Yes.
Well, it ought to make sense, right? Mm. Like, everybody who saw that ought to go, yeah, well, XYZ should be making that much money and deserves that raise because of the work that person has been doing. And it got me and my co-founder at Glassdoor, is Bob Homan, who had worked with me at Expedia, development manager. It got us brainstorming on how we might build a product around that. Anyway, it was the same provocation marketing, very interesting data. The data coming out of Glassdoor, the data coming out of Zillow, we realized with folks like Amy Butinsky, we could actually create a machine that kept pumping that data out through local newspapers and local publications on a daily basis. And we found that especially for real estate information, but also job information, there was kind of an infinite news hole. Like, newspapers and media outlets would publish interesting stuff every day about real estate and jobs if they could, and many of them do. So we realized that we built an organization kind of Bloomberg-like to pump this data out into the world, and that is how we earned our media.
Amazing. All right, we all know the one thing that separates great startups from the good ones is product velocity. What does it mean, product velocity? Fancy term, right? You got your product and you have velocity. Speed. The speed in which your product improves. So can you ship updates? Can you release new features? Can you do bug fixes? Can you iterate on the interface? Can you solve problems for your customers? And can you do it quickly? Because you're not alone. You have competitors and your customers have choices. They may solve their problems by writing their own custom code, or they might use your solution. This is what startups are about. How fast can you get that product velocity going? And so, how do you supercharge it? Everybody says, okay, yeah, we want to go faster, but you got to go faster intelligently. And Crowdbotics is going to help you do that. They're your CTO as a service. Basically, they provide you with the most optimal architecture to get your product to market as fast as possible. You'll have access to an on-demand product manager and developer talent, and they will help get your app into production 10 times faster than conventional development. Crowdbotics can work with your in-house dev team, or you can just have them work independently. And you own all the IP. You own all the source code. Let the folks at Crowdbotics supercharge your product velocity today. No more waiting. Get a free build plan at crowdbotics.com/twist. That's a $4.99 value just for the Twist listeners. You get that for free. That's crowdbotics.com/twist for a free build plan. Going back to Zillow, and your experience there. The other thing that I think you're a master of is branding. Expedia, Zillow, Glassdoor. All of them just incredibly well done. I'm a branding aficionado myself. I know how hard it is to name stuff. Take us through the naming of each of those companies and how you got there. I know, you know, this is something you're very passionate about. And then you were had an interview and you talked, you said you had a whole theory about branding. And the person was like, that's great. Let me go to my next question. Yeah. And I like literally almost threw my phone against the wall because I was like, he just told you he has a theory of branding. The guy's made three of the most iconic web properties or just properties, companies. And you literally let it go down the river and get lost forever. So let's unpack this here.
Okay.
Rich Barton's theories on branding and creating iconic names go.
Okay. The title of the blog post is actually out there. It's something like, you know, syllables and high point Scrabble letters. I do. It's out there. And back when you were already blogging a lot, I tried to blog for a little while, you know, and you know how that goes for guys like me. We do a few blog posts and we forget about it and it just sits there forever on the web. So there is a blog post that you guys can pull up and put in the show notes. The website is called hopperanddropper.com. That's a fly fishing term. And there is a post in there on blogging. There we go. Syllables, Scrabble letters, and picking brand names. Here it is. Those of you on video are seeing it right now. 2009, I wrote this.
Okay. Love it. This is after the great financial crisis. So you're probably somewhere just absolutely licking your wounds, wondering if it's the end of the world.
It was a big time. I was running Zillow. Yeah, I was running Zillow. We had to lay off 35% of the company after the, you know, it was a
financial crisis. Yeah,
the GFC happened in the real estate industry with mortgages, right?
And we were like, by the real estate industry. Let's be honest. It was caused by the real estate industry, and then
we were money losing pre-revenue. Oh my God, that was a
were you public at the time?
No, we were private, but it was losing money, really rough. 150 people. I think we had to lay off about 60 people. It was rough. That was one of the lower points.
Laying off people. Yeah. Was that your first major layoff? Or had you done any at Microsoft and Expedia?
I'd had experience with small scale ones, but nothing like this.
Your leg shake? Did you puke? Did you get the sweats?
I actually wrote about it, J. Cal. Mm-hmm. I had to journal on it to dump all the awful feelings I had, get them out onto paper and talk to people about it because it did rile me up. I have to say, you know, I've had to do it since then. And like it or not, we do get desensitized to it. I really, really believe you have to treat people with humanity on the way in and the way out. And you want to leave the door wide open because a lot of times they come back when you do.
Yeah.
And when we did have a lot of boomerangs, you know, that's what I call the people that come back. Those are the very best employees are the boomerangs, by the way.
Well, and it also is indicative of great management. I've had a number of them as well. And the conversation is always very encouraging, which is I frequently have people say, you know, we had our battles, but I really enjoyed working with you. There was just something about the energy and the dynamic nature of it. Would love to work with you again. I think that's like, people don't know how good they had it, you know, on both sides. You have some employees who you don't appreciate when they're working for you, and there are employees who don't appreciate you. They get some great job offer, and then they just come back 18 months later and like, you know what? This is home. This is better, right? That's one of the greatest feelings.
Sometimes you got to break up before you know you're in love, right? And then that happens a lot.
Why do you think first-time founders take it so hard that you got to journal, talk to a therapist, whatever, get some counseling over it, just that it just hits you like a ton of bricks? What was on that paper that you wrote?
Because we're human, you know, and we care, and we care about people more than we care about anything else. And we care about socializing and our friends and support and giving more than we care about anything else, most of us.
Yep.
And so it hurts. And I also think we get this, especially when we're young in our careers, we get a little bit confused about our jobs and our families, our coworkers and our families. And it feels a lot of young startups that I've been a part of, that you've been a part of, I'm sure it does feel like a family.
Yes.
And breaking up with your family is kind of the worst thing you can imagine, right? And so that's what it feels like. As you get later in your career, you come to realize that your work is actually not your family. That's not to say it doesn't have humanity in society. It does. but it is more like a professional sports team than it is a family, or yes, it should be. Okay. And we are here to do a job and play a game and win the game.
Mm-hmm.
And we want the very best players in each position, because if we have a weak point guard, we're not going to be able to score.
Nope.
You know, and so I don't want to take that too far. If you take that to an extreme, you get to Reed Hastings at Netflix. You know, he really, yeah, really, that's his that's his theory of HR.
And, you know, an interesting theory, created a high performance culture. But anybody who's in our industry knows at the end of the year, you got Netflix people who have to basically reapply for their job in January. And if you've got kids, if you've got friendship at work, if you've got mortgage payments, that's rattling, and people want safety.
Yep.
And I think he created an unsafe environment, which is appealing to certain groups of people, but it might be a little too cutthroat. I wonder if he still holds that opinion now that they're successful at scale. I don't know. I doubt he does.
I've been on that board for 21 years and still am, actually. So I'll give you a little context.
I didn't realize you were on the board. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been on the board since it was private, Jason.
Oh,
so,
wow.
But incredible company.
Unbelievable.
And I've learned,
I'm a shareholder.
Learned a ton. And, you know, I love it when people do things in extreme and interesting and novel ways, because then it begins to make you test all of your theories. Right.
Right.
And anyway, so Reed has done that for me. I'd say more than any other person. But he is now executive chairman. He is no longer CEO, and
right,
the company is a lot bigger, and the company operates in a highly creative enterprise where the most important thing they're doing is actually creating stories and content with creative people.
Right.
And so, of course, cultures evolve. I would,
yes,
say the foundations of Reed's performance-oriented culture are there, but it is evolving. It is absolutely evolving and
adapt.
Evolving well. Yeah.
Yeah. Back to branding.
Okay.
And by the way, I love the sports team analogy, I think, because I was just, again, one of the things that comes up a lot is I watched the, what's the movie based on the Michael Lewis book on baseball?
Moneyball.
So I just got the Moneyball where Philip Seymour Hoffman, rest in peace. I mean, what an actor.
Oh my God.
He gets into an argument with Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, you're not playing him on first base. He's like, oh, I'm playing him. The roster's mine. He's like, nope, you're not playing him tonight. He's like, I am playing him, and that's that. And he's like, you're not playing him because he doesn't work for our team anymore. And he's trading him. And he's just like, you're killing me. And it's just such a great scene. But it's very hard sometimes to make those decisions. Hey, the team started, and what got us here is not going to get us there. You know, this player, you know, you see it all the time in product and finance and sales. An organization gets to a certain scale, that person just can't level up. And they don't want to. They're 0 to 1. They're not, you know, 1 to 1,000 in terms of employees, right?
Most of those conversations, founders dread having that conversation. But in my experience, it's liberating for the people you're having the conversation with as well. It really is. Because everybody wants to, you know, achieve their highest and best use, and really wants to contribute in a way that everybody believes they're contributing as well. And getting the right people in the right places and letting them thrive, that's fantastic. Anyway, so back to the branding. Back to branding. Otherwise, we risk burying that one again. It's a fun blog post. Check it out from the show notes. But basically, I believe, first of all, fundamentally, I believe making up words.
Mm.
If you're building a consumer brand, especially, okay,
yep,
a little bit different for B2B. Some of the same principles hold, though. If you're building a consumer brand, making up a new word is better than taking a pre-existing word.
Okay.
Okay. Zappos is better than sneakers.com.
Got it.
Okay.
And the reason is?
But those of you out there are saying, oh, but sneakers.com is going to get SEO right away.
Yeah.
So I don't need to work very hard. And Zappos, who the hell knows what Zappos means? I'm going to have to tell people what Zappos means. Okay. That's absolutely right. So making up a word is harder initially and more expensive initially. But when you are successful making up a word, you own the word. You have defined the word. You have filled that word with the emotions that you want to have it filled with that come from your product. And then that word, if you get lucky enough to get something like Zillow, you've added to the vocabulary of humanity.
Yes.
Okay.
Uber, Airbnb.
So many Google. Great examples.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many great examples. Okay. So I really like the harder route, which is make up a word and then own a word. Whereas if you were sneakers.com, you get really big, you know, it just, there's no connectivity. Sneaker means something to people already. All right. Amazon is an interesting counterexample that existed already and had meaning, but Bezos took that word and completely redefined it.
Yes. I was about to bring that up. Like calm.com is another example. We're investors in that one, but it's a meditation app. It's an existing word. It's a four-letter word. It's in the dictionary. It's evocative, but meditation is not necessarily calm. It's an output of calm. Uber exists as a word, you know, the top thing.
Yeah.
But again, you know, and I think Airbnb, I remember talking to the founders early on, they were considering just calling it Air. And I had this like big branding conversation with them. And I love the concept of Air. And I was like, you should maybe do that. I don't know. You like Airbnb or Air?
I like Airbnb way better because it's theirs.
You like Airbnb better. Okay.
Yeah. I don't like it syllables. Let's get to syllables.
Syllables.
So
here we go.
I like making up words. Then once you decide you're going to make up a word, here are things that I like. I like high point Scrabble letters.
Okay.
What are those?
Z's, X, Q's.
Yeah. Right. They're high point for a reason. Why are they high point?
They don't there aren't that many words with them.
They're rare. Bingo.
They're rare.
Okay. Rare letters are memorable.
Interesting.
Rare letters jump off the page. Subconsciously, if you could look at a screen of text, the Z's and the Q's and the X's, see them. You see them in your field of vision and you're processing them.
Mm.
Because they're rare, everything else that's not rare. So I like high point Scrabble letters. Clearly, Elon Musk does too.
X.com.
Yeah, X. I do like X's. Expedia.
High point
Scrabble letters. Mm-hmm. Okay. Second thing I learned, I made a little bit of a mistake with Expedia. Expedia.
Four syllables. Too many. Two is the right number.
Two is the right number, I think.
Google. Yahoo.
Yep.
Facebook.
Yep.
Airbnb.
Too many. Too many, but still a good one because it's unique.
Not bad. Yeah. Amazon.
Amazon. One too many.
Okay, though.
Yeah. So it doesn't have to tick all the boxes.
It's a framework. Are you still using your personal phone number for your startup? It's 2023. It's time to stop. It is a huge mistake that founders make. Why? You're just getting started with your company and you don't think about phone numbers as being an important part of the IP collection of your startup. With OpenPhone, you can totally solve this problem. They've rethought everything about a modern business phone and how it should work. It's super easy. You just download the app on your phone or your desktop and you pick a number and you're done. And you do it for just such a low price. It's so affordable. And think about it. If you have your sales team using their personal phone numbers, a salesperson leaves and goes to a competitor, you don't have any insight into what phone calls occurred, what people's phone numbers are. That's your company's database. And if you allow the sales team to run amok or the customer support team, it's just unprofessional. Be professional. Use OpenPhone. And we use it for things like event communication. So we get one phone number, but it can go to multiple people, like a round robin thing where you have a shared phone number. Do that for customer support. And OpenPhone is rated number one on G2 for customer satisfaction. And you know, I trust G2's ratings. OpenPhone, it's ready, it's affordable, starts at just $13 a month. But Twist listeners can get 20% off any plan for the first 6 months at openphone.com/twist. And if you have existing numbers with another service, no problem, easy peasy, lemon squeezy, OpenPhone will port them over at no cost. Head to openphone.com/twist to start your free trial and get 20% off.
And then one other I like, maybe it's in the blog post, but I like it if it would make a good dog's name.
Oh.
Interesting. Just dog's names are dog's names because they're memorable and people respond. Dogs respond to them, which means something in our brains responds to them.
Fascinating.
verbs, if you can turn the word into a verb, you know you've made it as a consumer brand when you become a verb.
When you Google something, when you Zillow something. Yes.
And the lawyers will tell you, oh, don't never let your brand name be used as a verb because you're going to dilute your brand. Defensibility, whatever. I'm like, no, don't listen to that.
Every conversation I have with lawyers about intellectual property, fair use, trademarks, and copyrights is so fear-based.
Yes. And
it's the worst advice. Collectively, the IP industrial complex gives fear-based advice.
Yeah.
And it has no practicality. Like, they told you probably, do not do this Zestimate. You're going to get sued. I mean, what was the Glassdoor? I mean, you ask an attorney to evaluate the Zestimate or Glassdoor ratings, they're going to give you every reason not to do it.
Yeah, don't do it at all. Yeah, don't do it.
Don't do it. It's just too risky.
Founding of YouTube, don't do it. Founding of Uber, don't do it. Don't do it. Okay, so look, I believe that you can't be a successful startup. It's very hard to be a successful startup or a company without amazing attorneys. I have high respect. I do believe that something that lots of organizations, especially startups, a trap they do fall into is that the attorneys are so well educated, so smart, so articulate, they command the space so well that people kind of get confused about who's working for who.
Exactly. This is exactly what happens when I have conversation with David Sachs on Wall In. He's an attorney. And people are like, oh, wow. Yeah. No, Trump's not guilty. I'm like, are you sure? I'm no attorney, but
the hard way, the woes of like trying to debate a debate champion. That's what it feels like. Yeah.
It does.
You can't debate a debate champion.
You have to be able to say to an attorney, what do you say to an attorney when they're overpowering the room saying, hey, here's all the reasons that you're bending the rules and here's all the reasons you're going to get legal letters and sued. How do you, over your career, how did you get more confident in managing attorneys who are trying to do the right thing, but they don't want to get fired when you get sued? So they always take the most conservative path.
I guess the advice I'd give is to find attorneys to work at your company and to work outside your company who really are business people.
Mm.
Okay. They're business people and attorneys together. They're not just attorneys. And when you find one, and there are a lot of good ones who are business people, you basically partner with the attorney to make a business decision of which the legal advice is one component.
Mm.
Okay. And trying to really assess the amount of risk and how much risk are you, the entrepreneur or the business person, willing to take from a legal perspective. Some of the great companies have been created in that kind of, okay, it's not without risk, but we're going to plow ahead and do it because you know what? It's the right thing to do. It's what consumers want. And at the end of the day, I'm psyched about standing in any courtroom and wrapping myself in the consumer flag saying, I did the right thing. I let the sun shine in and gave power to the people.
This is, I think, such an instructive point. Because watching what Uber and Airbnb did, close up, investor in one, and just, you know, knowing the other pretty well, and even DoorDash and Postmates, you know, a lot of what they provided to the world was not already defined by the rule book. And when you looked at when they did stuff, to your point, power to the people, if somebody is using an Airbnb, DoorDash, or Uber, that is very empowering. If you live in Brooklyn and you couldn't get a cab, if you're living in Arizona and you're a retiree and you have no income and you can rent out your guest house, like, this empowered people in a major way. So when they did get resistance, they had an army of advocates who would say, yeah, we want Airbnb, we want Uber, we want DoorDash, we want Postmates.
And so ultimately we'll win, even though the regulations are set up to protect the folks who are doing it the way it's done right now, be it the taxi commission in New York City, whatever neighborhood regs versus Airbnb. You know, we had our own with early Zestimate. We had serious problems with the industry didn't want us in, and they were trying to use the regulations to get us basically illegalized and kicked out of the industry. And we had, I remember an amazing thing happened in Arizona where it got to Arizona Congress was debating this, the real estate lobby had brought all this pressure to bear. And we had all these Arizona Congress people get up and say, you got to be kidding. I love Zillow. Zillow is fantastic. It's helping me. Go away. And it just went away. But anyway, I'm not encouraging everybody to go break all the rules.
No.
You got to pick the rules. Pick the rules that you want to break based on what is the right thing for the consumer. And
so
you're going to win.
So a noble, you know, recontextualizing, I'll use that framing, of existing laws, noble. And I think this is where crypto, you know, was so promising at the start, but I found so abhorrent, you know, when all the hucksters came in. They pitched it originally as this is going to empower people. Hey, you're not going to be controlled by fiat currency. You're not going to have to pay all these fees. And then I was like, oh, you're just sweeping all this cash off the table, selling worthless tokens that don't solve any problem in the world. And so this whole moral high ground that they had staked, they never delivered on. They never empowered anybody to understand the price of their home or get a better deal on a home or get a taxi in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if there's a buck to be made, it's going to be made. And there was a lot of that. There was a lot of that there. I still hold out a lot of optimism around what emerges from the crypto bouillabaisse that actually is of value. And I think we'll probably begin to see that
emerge.
What do
you think is the valuable part of it? What intrigues you about it?
I mean, I really do believe that having a digital store of value and a cross-border, you know, meta currency, that concept is a very powerful and strong one. And it clearly is useful.
Mm.
And, you know, because of that, I think we're going to continue to see a lot of innovation here. Mm. I'm really kind of confused, though. I mean, we're in a little bit of a resurgence of meme stocks and resurgence of trash crypto right now. And I'm just like, in what world, in what economy is this being supported? I it's confusing to me that we're seeing that and a little bit distressing, but I think I guess I write it off simply as people like to play games, you know?
You literally finished my thought. In my brain, I'm like, I think there's a group of people who find going to a subreddit, debating a meme stock, and trying to cause a squeeze or just getting in a battle with some big hedge fund. It's entertainment. And then I think also buying crypto is entertainment for people. So it's like sports betting. You and I are looking at it as investment and securities and structures and alignment. And that makes it perplexing. Just like some people will look at a professional poker player and be like, they're playing a game for a living? I don't understand. And it's like, no, they have a strategy here. They're making $1 million a year playing poker. Actually, you could do it. You can do both things, right?
Yeah.
All right. You know, I've been on a health kick over the past year, and you know, I care about data-driven solutions. And if you listen to this podcast, I bet you do too. So let me tell you about Fitbod. This is a data-driven workout app that blends machine learning with exercise science. Fitbod creates custom dynamic workouts programs based on your fitness goals, your experience, and most interestingly to me, the available equipment. Let's say you got a bunch of kettlebells, or let's say you're at some, you know, sparse gym at a hotel, or you're on vacation, you got nothing. Well, Fitbod will maximize your fitness gains by varying the intensity and the volume between your sessions and leverage the equipment you have or don't have, as the case may be. You can customize the length of your workout, what muscles you want to target, and so much more. So let's say you want to get a 30-minute workout in, and I want to do chest, triceps, and abs, but I'm staying at an Airbnb. There's no equipment. Fitbod can create a perfectly optimized workout for me based on these parameters, and it'll do it for you too. Check it out. It's amazing. The design of this app is extraordinary. I was able to invest in it. That's how impressed I was with it. Fitbod takes the guesswork out of fitness. Just open the app and start making progress. You deserve it. Get 25% off your Fitbod subscription or try out the app for free when you sign up now at fitbod.me/twist. That's fitbod.me/twist for 25% off.
The industry you chose, you know, travel, there were incumbents, and HR, there's incumbents for Glassdoor, but that's nothing compared to real estate. Real estate's a cartel, so much so that there are lawsuits trying to crack this like 6%, three on each side, you know, there's like these real estate exchanges that own the data. When you came into the industry, there was a, I mean, anybody who comes in and tries to innovate in that industry is attacked. So maybe take me through the arc of Zillow and how they tried to stop you along the way, and then how they, how you converted that to support, or is it still like a standoff?
All right, let me, that's a great question.
Yeah.
JKL, great question. And let me start out by saying, before I rewind into the history and say, this assumption by smart tech and business types, like the two of us, that it's some cartel that needs to be cracked and we're just the only guys that can do it. That is a pretty commonly held belief by folks like us. And I would say it was one of the inspirations for me, honestly, getting into it, because it felt very, very right, very power to the people, turn on the lights. I've been in the industry now 17 or 18 years with Zillow, and I will tell you that our real estate industry here in the US is by far the cleanest, most liquid game in the world. Most real estate markets around the world have almost zero transparency, no clearinghouse marketplace where you can actually see all the inventory. Not a lot of places have buyer's representation. So I guess I would say I've learned to appreciate it and understand, of course, there are lots of pockets of information to be liberated and lots of efficiencies to be gained and a lot of ways we can make the interactions between buyer, seller, and our partners better. Tons and tons. And that is the space we live in. But I didn't want to just let you throw out the, it's a cartel. But
tell me, like, how did they try to stop you? How did you make them, you know, peace with them, or, you know,
any industry that's been around for a long time wants to hold on to the marketplace information. Okay. You can pick your industry, name your industry, and you find a set of legacy players who have a control of the marketplace information, and they don't want to release that for obvious reasons. But gravity tech, internet, smartphone says there's no way you can hold on to that information. That information does eventually want to be free. And the opportunity we saw with Zillow was being able to kind of tear down that wall, liberate that information, add a bunch of more information onto it, and create a much brighter lit, better operating marketplace. That is what drew us to it. I would tell you that because of Expedia, the travel industry really didn't like us. And I have had a lot of experience with the, let's call it the supply side of the marketplaces that I've been building, not wanting me to be there. Okay. And actively disliking it, disliking what I was doing. But I always felt I'm holding my hands up here. I've got the supply side of the marketplace egg. Here's the marketplace, the supply side on one side and the demand side on the other. So consumers over here on the other side. I've always felt that it's most important to engage the demand side, and that nobody on the supply side is going to show up unless you have, you're doing real magic tricks for the folks on the demand side. And no one's even going to take your calls and care that you exist unless you have the demand side. But if you do, in fact, show up with the demand side and you have engagement with the demand side of the marketplace, eventually the supply side is going to come around to dealing with you. That's kind of been my philosophy. Of course, both sides of the marketplace matter hugely to make a marketplace. You can't have it without both sides. But I've always believed that if a product manager is working on features and is trying to decide, should I do the right thing for the consumer or do the right thing for the supplier? Well, number one is the consumer. Number two is the supplier. That's what I talk
about. Of course, if you don't have happy consumers who like your mousetrap, you have nothing. And I got to see this up close in person, but some people believe the supply side is the hard part of a marketplace. So what do they, why do people fall for that fallacy that, oh, if I just had the supply, then everything would work out?
You know, I think we could probably pick examples where that has been true, especially for highly concentrated supply side industries, which there are plenty of, where you don't have too many competitors. There's
airlines would fall into that.
There you go. High degree of control. Yeah. And so, however, if it is highly fragmented supply side,
hotels
is perfect. than and you have a lot of choice. So it's to a certain extent somewhat commoditized in that it's replaceable or interchangeable, or you're able to steer traffic one way or another. Then you actually begin to focus more on the customer side. In any marketplace, you have to have both. I don't want to say that. Yeah. You know, you really have to have both. And by the way, it could be a fantastic consumer experience to have exclusive supply.
Mm.
Okay. You can only find Stranger Things on Netflix. That right. is a really good consumer experience. Okay.
Yes.
So it's, I'm nuancing a bit what I said.
Yeah.
But in general, I believe, at least in the companies that I love and that I've been a part of, that the consumer is your North Star.
Yeah.
That is what we should be. And by the way, that's the most fun to me anyway. So.
Yeah. I mean, if you can delight a consumer, you're going to have them use the product again. And using the product again or telling your friend about the product and why you love it are the two most powerful things in consumer land, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We were working on word of mouth stuff before there was social media, before there was smartphone, you know?
Yeah.
Zillow, the Zestimate predated the smartphone.
Yeah.
Okay. And predated social media. There was no social media at that point. And so word of mouth was like standing on the sidelines of the kids' soccer game and talking to each other.
It was, we call it over the shoulder. Yes. David Sacks came up with that one. Two Sacks references one episode, but he was talking about Uber and I had invested in it and then he invested in a later round and we were talking about it. And he said, this thing is so viral. I'm like, how is it viral? The give to get, like the $25. He's like, no, when I order an Uber and I take somebody, they ask me if I have a driver and I say, no, I have Uber. And then they say, what's Uber? And then I take out my phone and I show them to them. And I was like, ah, it's like over the shoulder. And he's like, yeah, it's like over the shoulder virality.
Yeah.
I'm like, we've all had that moment where somebody takes out a phone and does something magical on their phone. And you're like, how did you perform alchemy and magic?
Wait, show me that.
Show me that spell.
What is that?
And it's like, show me that. Yeah. Apps or spells, right? Just like, here's something amazing.
Be a wizard. I love that analogy. Be a wizard. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you can conjure up something that delights a consumer, that is magic, right? And it's so rare that you know it when you see it, right? It is.
Then you got to think, what does it take to make magic? And you really have to find magicians. And I mean, something that, I grew up at Microsoft in the early 90s, right out of college. And there weren't many.
What was your first job there?
I was product manager of MS-DOS 5.
Really?
Not many of your listeners.
I was on MS-DOS, but I think I went to Windows Runtime 3.0 and then DOS 5.0 still exists. That was like parallel.
We did. It was parallel for a while. You had to actually put the Windows. You had to put Windows on top of DOS. Yeah, exactly. And DOS 5 Windows. Was the first time we did a retail upgrade of the OS. Until then, you had to basically wipe everything off your computer and then install the new operating system and then rebuild all your apps and all your data and everything, right? And so the idea with DOS 5, it was Bill Gates's idea, was, hey, could we like write a little program that lifted up all your apps and data, swapped out the OS, and then set them back
the
gently down?
And put it back down. Yeah. And you're like, that's insane. And now we have over-the-air updates and they occur without us even knowing.
What was insane about that was the software was sold in packages then. We didn't have the internet, right? So it was the most popular software SKU sold of all time by a factor of 10.
DOS and Windows.
The DOS 5 upgrade. Literally, incredible. Egghead, we did a midnight Egghead did a midnight madness sale. We had people camped out
to get DOS
waiting, 5. Get the DOS 5 upgrade.
And it was like, there were like five bullet points on the back of them. People forget this, but the way you interacted with software was you went to CompUSA or Fry's or whatever store, and there were like VHS tapes at Blockbuster packaged. You could go buy Netscape. You would go buy a browser for $99. You go buy a video game. You would go buy the operating system. When the operating systems came out, it was a BFD. It was a big deal in Nerdland.
Oh yeah.
So you were going to say about what you learned at Microsoft. That was an interesting time. The 90s was when they were firing on all cylinders and they were about to peak and get their knuckles wrapped by the antitrust department, which will be a great jumping off point for a lot of discussion.
What was what was amazing to me at that, I had studied engineering in college, but I wasn't practicing engineering at Microsoft, but I was dangerous enough that I could hang with those folks, right? And it totally felt like we knew magic. We were wizards and the rest of the world was full of muggles and,
yeah,
you know, let's make some spells and change the world. I mean, it was really a magical time. And honestly, I feel that way today. There are a lot more people that are involved in tech now and a lot more engineers and a lot more product people and designers and marketers that are so fantastic. But in general, it's still a pretty small segment of really special creators of products, okay, of technology products. And if you can find those people, I'm talking to the folks out there, just find those people and take any job you can get to hang around with those people.
What do those people have in common? If we look at the people who have that alchemy, that ability to cast a spell, what are the attributes you see? Obviously, Gates and Jobs, Elon, you know, Jack, you know, doing Square and Twitter. I mean, there's a lot of interesting people in that. I wouldn't put Zuckerberg in there because he just copied everybody's stuff. I would put Evan Spiegel in there for sure. You got to put Reed Hastings in there. What do those people all have in common, the conjurers?
You know, I was just listening to the names as you were throwing them out because I don't really have a pat answer to your question. So I was looking for patterns. And I guess I would say I was steeped in that environment of Microsoft. So I absorbed it by osmosis. But I guess listening to that list, I would say it's the people who love products. And you know the people who love products because as they move through the physical world or the virtual world with you and you watch them, they are continually frustrated by bad products and bad design. You know, like Crestron home interfaces for managing your lights and music. Okay. Ooh. Like
Crestron.
I hate control to say this, four. But these big soft controls in the cars now with these giant screens. Look, God, the knob worked better. Okay. Yes. It was better. My light switch works better than this panel of bull. You know, and
seven clicks to get to something.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So you know those people in your life, and maybe you're one of those people. Okay. Yeah. But in fact, I think those are the people that you want to hang around with.
Yeah.
Those are the people you want to, those people are the ones who are going to invent the future breakthrough products, I think.
You know, one thing I think with those folks, you know, investing in them for a living now is they're very, what's the word when, I don't want to say cantankerous, but they're very annoyed when things should work better and they don't. They're what's the word? They're not insufferable, but they're intolerant of product.
Yep.
And
they're frustrated and they're tenacious and they're critical and sometimes they're not the most tactful in their sharing of feedback.
Gates was the penultimate, I mean, ultimate. I mean, he was known for savaging people. Tell me about Gates in that period, because he was at the height of his powers in the 90s.
Yeah, when I started at Microsoft,
90% of desktops were Microsofts at the time, to give people context.
Yeah, when I started at Microsoft in 91, we had maybe 3,000 people at the company. So not small, but certainly not big, barely medium sized. And Bill Gates at that time was, the company was still of the scale where he knew everything about every product company and was running product reviews continuously through his conference room. And so every product team at the company would cycle through every 6 to 12 months and, you know, present what they were working on, the progress they were making, et cetera. And it was mostly kind of product management, engineering, little program management, you know, not a lot of sales and marketing, but sometimes. And, you know, Bill had a kind of earned reputation for being incredibly difficult. Just Steve Jobs had the same kind of reputation as well for just being incredibly critical and difficult and hard on folks. I learned a lot about how great product people think, but I also learned a lot at the time about how how I deliberately tried to create cultures that were able to be critical, but also simultaneously respectful. And I would say Bill Gates has learned that in his lifetime as well. So
why do you think at that period of time, the, you know, let's say no a-hole rule didn't really exist? And it was actually a bit more of a pirate ship, and you could kind of get away with that, or that was the culture, which was, I don't care if you're going to cry, and if I can make you cry when I give you this feedback, great, because I need to get you the off the ship, because there can be no crybabies here, and if you don't want to come in and work this weekend 12 hours to fix this, you're walking the plank. That was, to give people historical culture, the 80s and 90s, tech was pirate ships fighting in the open ocean. And if you were on that ship and you complained, you walked the plank, period, full stop, correct?
It was pretty rough. You know, it was a culture that you and I probably were well suited. Let's say that. Okay.
But why was it like that? And what was it?
It was a bunch of dudes. It was a bunch of young dudes.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's really 20 somethings. Smart.
Yeah. 20, we're all, we, you know, Bill was 18 when he started Microsoft, okay?
People forget.
My co-founder at Zillow, Lloyd Frank, started working for Microsoft at the age of 14 years old when there were 22 people, because he went to the same high school Bill Gates went to.
14.
And his mom and Bill Gates' mom were friends, and they were at some school function in Seattle, and you know, Bill's mom said to Lloyd's mom, my son's really into computers. And Lloyd's mom said, so's mine. Like, we should get them together. Anyway, it was a bunch of dudes, and they were young and they were smart. And that particular mix of folks created this pirate culture that you're talking about. Of course, that culture grew up. Those people grew up. And, you know, we've recognized that to harness the maximum amount of power we can in this space, being way more inclusive about the group of creators that we bring into the space, meant that there had to be a different culture. And so we have all, maybe not all, you know, there may be some organizations that still operate this way, but not mine.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And do you think the culture got too soft during the Google, you know, we're going to do your dry cleaning and here's your infinity pool and hey, 20% of the time, do whatever you want. Or if you want to do nothing and just hang out on the roof and rest and vest at Hooli, you can. And then we're now cleaning a bit of that up. So did the pendulum go too far the other way and create a little bit of entitlement culture?
I mean, I think broadly speaking, in the industry, I think it's a keen observation. It's not how I've thought about my companies though, J-Cal. I do believe that that culture is a symptom of simply not having really cool, important stuff to work on.
Ah,
like it's
too much success on the original idea, maybe?
Maybe too much success, or just like you're not now doing cool things that fire you up. I believe when you're on a mission to build something amazing and you're making progress and you're working with your team, I believe what people really want is to work on cool stuff with great people and win. That's what I think.
And winning change everything. I mean, even if the culture is a little bit off, if you win, people are like, Draymond punched somebody, but we won, right? So if they won this year and Draymond punched somebody, who cares? It's only like, you know, when you don't win and the things were chaotic that you're like, maybe we need to evaluate here. What is the culture you try to breed? Knowing what you know about entitlement culture, you know, on one side, and then pirate culture maybe being a little too rough and tumble for, you know, today's environment. What culture did you define for your companies?
I would do put a third leg on that triangle, and basically say, oh, look, have a real kind of mission-driven company that's building something that matters to people, that we can talk to our moms and sisters and brothers about and SOs about, and that gets them really fired up. Have it be have a goal that is a big, hairy, audacious goal that seems super important, you know, to people. And then assemble a really diverse team of adventurers to go summit that particular mountain. You know, that's Mount Rainier in Seattle. You know, in fact, probably it's over my shoulder on my background.
I see
here.
It there, yeah.
That,
amazing.
This is my actual office, though it's a virtual version because I'm on the road. Rainier is the destination. We want to stand on top of Rainier. That's what we want to do. Let's go do that.
Yes.
And in order to get there and make it through the storm and the hail and the lightning and the river we got to cross to get to the base of the mountain and whatever, we have to have a really great team that respects each other and respects every component of it. Mm. Not just the leader, you know, not just the engineer, you know, not just the storyteller. Like we need everybody. We need the whole wheel and all the spokes tightened to make the wheel roll. And so the kind of culture that I like is a culture of respect and inclusivity, but hardcore adventurers, you know, trying to summit the mountain.
Yeah. And the purpose then makes everything kind of lock into place because people understand, hey, this is the mission. And then, you know, here's our strategies, here's our tactics, whatever, you know, you can get granular on it. But at least if everybody knows the mission of where you're headed, it gets easier. Yeah.
Yeah, it gets easier and you get through the dark times because there are times mm-hmm. when you can't see the mountain. And, you know, if you don't really have a clear picture of where the mountain is, what it's going to feel like to be there, then you get lost in the dark, right? You get lost in the storm. So that's what leadership, you know, that's what leadership is. And for the leaders out there, you know, painting a picture of the wonderful future and the destination and communicating that in a compelling way that gets people fired up, that's what serves you in recruiting. That's what serves you in building great products. That's what serves you well in signing up partners and suppliers. That's what gets you there.
You know, this COVID thing was quite an interesting catalyst and also, you know, headwind for different businesses. Airbnb, I had Brian Chesky and Joe Gebbia on this year. And they both said this is like, you know, crucible moment, as Ruloff both would say from Sequoia, crucible moment for the company. And there's a bit of a crucible moment for you as well at Zillow.
COVID? Sorry, I got distracted.
Yeah, COVID. Yeah, saying? COVID. Yeah, and that moment in time, and then everybody going remote. This had massive impact on your running of the business, some of the business lines you were in, like flipping homes or being an iBuyer, I think is a term you use for it in your industry.
Yeah.
And then, you know, brokers not being able to show houses. I mean, talk about the chaos of the last 3 or 4 years and this work from home trend, which impacts your business because everybody wants to buy a bigger home, right. But also impacts your ability to run a company. So walk me through like the last couple of years in coming out of this COVID shock to the system, because I don't think we ever experienced anything like it. The great financial crisis felt like a cakewalk compared to this in some ways.
I think it's been the most important and interesting and complicated and fraught and quite actually wonderful in a way, you know, weirdly experience in my lifetime, you know, in my business lifetime, my personal lifetime, everything. It will be the thing that defines our generation, I think. We're going to be...
I thought it would be 9/11. But yeah, it's COVID because 9/11 was, you know, contained in some places. But so
yeah, so all the trends that you talked about, you know, dead bang on. I mean, I think it's trite to say at the time, but you know, it's trite to say now. But really, COVID, what it did was accelerate by N years, 5 years or more. A lot of the kind of pre-existing trends, and name your industry, name your political movement, name your whatever. And COVID had a way of just breaking through a lot of the legacy crap that was holding back progress on these trends.
Yeah.
Okay. And in that way, it's like one of the most innovative times we've seen, right? You know, we had Zoom at the company, we had Slack at the company, but they weren't very well used. Right. And then all of a sudden, bang, they became the two most important things happening at the company.
Everybody's got a podcast studio now in their house or office, right? They got a professional mic and a great camera and lighting.
We already were tending towards more hybrid work and much more nomadic work. And boom, this like blasted that one out of the
telemedicine.
We already were moving towards telemedicine. We're already moving towards digital document, digital routing of mortgage documents, but we hadn't gotten there, but boom, now we got to, because we can't meet. Yes. Okay. So, you know, all of these pre-existing things just got blasted forward. It was a huge, initially in the real estate market, it was a huge wind at the back for transactions because everybody wanted to move. And so we saw a huge amount of demand pick up to move. And so Zillow as a business experienced this incredible, you know, it wasn't quite like Zoom and Peloton, but it was kind of, you know, in that same vein because so many people wanted to move. And then, of course, you do, you know, we get the rebound from that. And we're seeing that. Interestingly, if you looked at the plot of Zillow unique users on Google Trends or something over that time, you wouldn't actually see too much, which is sort of interesting. But it did change the behavior of moving itself. It kind of front loaded some transactions. And now we're dealing with the echo. Another aspect of it was, you know this well, but capital was free. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Interest rates were basically zero and, you know, capital startups were, and big companies alike, were swimming in capital.
And so we had,
we unlike anything we've seen, you know, we thought we saw it in 99. We thought we saw the most euphoria you could possibly see. And that was nothing compared to what we saw in the zero interest rate period, right?
People would just offer you, they would come to a company like yours and say, hey, here's money. How can you put it to use? Where
That's
we
right.
have money to put in your bank account and you can pay us back at 2%, or even personally, they're just, oh, you have a bunch of stock? Here's some line of credit that is unbelievably low. And people are like, yeah, I should just buy the stock market with this. And
yeah.
I mean, people got themselves in trouble with leverage, but
right.
it so, was
so,
crazy.
So a bunch of new businesses emerged where capital availability was the defining competitive characteristic, right? So, you know, the ability to raise an infinite amount of money at a very cheap price hatched new business ideas as a result.
Yeah.
And so we saw a lot of that in the market. And one of those ideas was kind of trying to flip homes at scale and provide a more efficient marketplace, the iBuying concept pioneered by Opendoor, who's a partner of ours now. And at Zillow, this was one of the things we were like, all right, well, we can raise the capital too. This might be super important. Consumers seem to really like it. If we can get it to big scale, we should give it
a
shot.
Explain what a concept of iBuying is. What was the thing that attracted you to it? What was the thing that made it appealing to people?
Just less hassle in moving. Like, you know, it's very hard to coordinate the buy and the sell when you're moving from one house to the other. If you're a first-time buyer, this is no problem. Okay, other than affordability. If you're selling a house and buying a new house, the problem of managing all the logistics between those two things and not being able to carry two mortgages makes it difficult. And so if there is a market maker that sits in the middle that could temporarily own the house, fix it up, and then sell it, and you could get your money and then get onto your next house, well, that has some consumer appeal to it. The problem we encountered, however, was that prices turned in COVID, especially prices turned out to be way more volatile than we ever anticipated they could be, which made the calculation for market making and holding inventory become much more dangerous and risky. And so, you know, we tried it for a while, decided, we're software people. We're not big capital, big balance sheet people. We're going to stop doing that. And we're going to partner with the innovator in the space, Opendoor, to do it. And
is that what you did? You guys did a deal to give them your inventory to kind of work it out, as it were?
No, we didn't do the inventory deal with them. We simply did a partnership with them on a go forward basis. We had no problem. We made this call in November of 2021. So before the interest rate thing happened. I just got nervous. And so before interest rates went up and made everything look horrible in the whole world, we were in houses. It was super easy to sell a house. We were able to unload all of our inventory before this.
I took a lot of crap
for this at the time, you know, from my people too. And it involved a lot of layoffs and it was rough. But we as a leadership team looked pretty smart pretty shortly after that. Because we had gotten out of the business. So anyway,
but owning
this is a lesson in learning.
Owning thousands of homes requires you to be able to have unpredictable swings. Being a publicly traded company, that's not great for running a public company. If you're some private equity firm or some giant hedge fund, it's a lot easier to own 1,000 homes, 2,000 homes if you're only, you know, if you're looking at it with a longer window and you're not doing public quarterly earnings calls, correct?
Correct. And especially if you're a software person who's used to, you know, 93% gross margins, which is how I grew up, you know, and dealing with 4% gross margins, you just have to be really good, way better than I am, J.Cal.
I don't know if it was Warren Buffett or something. He was talking about how hard it is to compete in like 2-3 star hotels, the Holiday Inns, whatever. And it's like, there are specific Indian families, cartels, basically, who are so good at operating these things that nobody can operate them better than this group and these families that own those hotels. And you shouldn't even try operating.
Don't try.
Like, why would you bother? Like, it's just too hard.
Right.
When we look at what's happening in the market, high interest rates, maybe staying high for longer than people think, what impact is that having on the markets, especially after all of these COVID towns bumped? And then we'll get into, are people going to come back to offices? Because we were looking at maybe moving to Austin. I was pretty public about it. We were considering it.
Yeah.
And this, the houses like tripled in price. And I'm like, wait, how are you getting 20? How are you asking $2,500 a square foot when that's the price in Atherton? That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So, and there's no, you don't record the prices in Texas. So you can't even do an analysis of what's happening. And I was like, I'll just wait for this all to calm down. Now it turns out some of those places are collapsing, right? So maybe you can just tell us like what's happening post all this movement. And then is the market frozen with these 6-7% mortgages, or is it possible that society can deal with the 6-7% mortgage rate?
Yeah, it's logical that some of those, you know, Zoom towns, I guess they were called at the time, you know, Salt Lake City, Bozeman, Austin, you know, the Hamptons, wherever, you know, they are definitely experiencing a pullback. Mm. Truth be told, though, none of those places is very big and couldn't absorb that many people anyway. And so they were in, they made for interesting headlines, but that is really not the big story. The bigger story in people movement, I called it the great reshuffling at the time, in people movement catalyzed by COVID is not necessarily people moving completely out of the city to a brand new city in a mountainous state or what have you. It's actually people moving into the donuts around cities. So the ring, the thick ring of places around cities is what has really been enjoying it. It has the capacity to absorb a lot of movers. And it's like stimulated a real boom in these donuts around cities to the detriment of the downtowns, which is, you know, which is what's been, we're trying to recover from right now. And that's interesting. And that makes a lot of sense. People who are working 2 or 3 days a week going into the office that can commute at the times they choose, that what they want to move to a place that has a yard, maybe a little bit different school where they can walk the dog, whatever. And that's really been the predominant trend. Mm. So now what we're looking for, and a lot of people are watching very carefully, especially if you're in the commercial real estate business that has investments in office towers in downtowns, you're trying to figure out what the heck's going to happen with all that space. Anyway, so that's kind of the big story.
What do you think happens? Do you think people go back to offices? What are you doing at your company? Or are those going to have to get converted?
It doesn't look good for them, J.Cal.
So, it does not look good, right?
It does not look good.
Explain.
I think it's way worse than it even looks in the data that you see, because, you know, the utilization rates, the kind of what's being rented out right now in these offices, pick your city, is kind of in the 85% range right now, which is galactically low numbers. But if you actually look at usage, it's way below that. And then you start thinking, all right, what are employers going to do? You're not going to rent space for like the Wednesday when everybody's in. You're not going to like rent for peak loading. You're going to actually figure out how to optimize how much space you use so that you, when on the peak days, you're not going to be able to take everybody, but you're also not going to be empty on Friday and Monday. Anyway, it's a really, really tough problem for downtown.
The hybrid
and commercial
issue is very real because. Yeah, you're looking at it. I'm assuming you're going hybrid. Is that your philosophy going forward? Or do you believe in Or do you believe like you need to get people back to an office to really do your best work? I mean, what do you candidly believe?
I'll come to that in a sec, but I think the answer, my intuition, the answer about what a new city is going to look like is we have to rethink cities to the point where we are intermingling life, shopping, entertainment, and work.
Mm-hmm.
The places that have intermingled those beautifully are thriving. The ones who have hived off high-rise downtowns, and that's where your office work happens, and then over here is where the living happens, and then over here is where the shopping happens, that is an unsustainable model. What people want is an intermingled live, work, shop, eat, play. That's what they want. Anyway, so I think that's how it's going to play out. With Zillow, I saw the writing on the wall really early June, July of 2020, so first year of the pandemic. I was like, oh my God, we're working really well together in the cloud. This definitely and obviously feels like the future to me. Let's burn the ships and let's liberate people. And then if you were living in New York City, but your lease was coming up, I said, go ahead and move back to Ohio, be near your parents. No problem. We'll never make it a job requirement that you move back to New York City. And so we basically went to what I call Cloud HQ early on, not without its problems, but oh my God, I'm so thankful that we didn't have to do this hokey pokey negotiation between management and employees that's going on at so many companies right now.
Amazon, 3+2, Facebook,
4+1.
Yeah, everybody is.
Everybody.
Well, I mean, there is some amount of abuse that is occurring. There is a lack of mentorship for young people. And, you know, there's some amount of collisions. I've heard you talk about this before in interviews that occurs by being in person. So what have you lost that you lament by having the Cloud HQ? What have you lost and that you're struggling to recreate?
I mean, I think the early career mentorship thing is a real issue. And our solution may be that we just do less of that. You know, we have more experienced people. It could be that we'll see. The collision in the hallways thing is real, but we're getting all kinds of more collisions in Slack and Zoom as well. If you're using those tools correctly, or Teams, if you're using those tools correctly, there's a new kind of meeting format where I've got Slack up, and Chrissy's telling me, your time is getting tight. We're multitasking and making decisions in meetings, right? Which has never happened before. Like, we had to have the meeting after the meeting to make the decision because you couldn't say what you were really thinking in the meeting. But now we can do it in Slack and just say, this is the answer, and everybody moves on.
There's some more efficiency that's occurring because of this.
Way more. We still get together though. So Cloud HQ for me means, you can decide, you can choose in these three time zones where you live, no problem whatsoever. But you are going to be, for a lot of job types at least, you are going to be required to get together at least once a quarter with your team.
Once a quarter for a week. If you got a family, if you got kids, whatever, you got to make that work. That's part of the deal.
And people have a blast, and it's like the human thing, and you get to know people and you make the human bonds. And then when you go back into your Cloud HQ seat, you have more personal relationships and you're more effective. So that's working extremely well.
You need 25% of the office space that you had?
I think that'll be right. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're at 35% now. We'll probably get down to 15 or 20% of pre-pandemic space.
See, this is the fascinating part, that it is worse, because I know that the statistics you're talking about are correct. The vacancy rate in San Francisco, I think, is like 30%, which is absurd, right? Like 30% is crazy. You said 15% is crazy. Right. San Francisco is 30%. But I know that other 70% is being used 15%.
That's right.
Or let's give it 30%. Oh my God.
Unsustainable.
It's empty down there. It's truly, truly scary. All right, listen, I know you got to go. You gave me a full 75 minutes. I appreciate it. I was really concerned with this because I told you at one point, like, I'd invited you so many times, and I was just like,
you were like, did I say something mean to you?
I literally insulted
a lot of people, and I didn't know. I'm not good like that.
I was like, this has happened now three times. I was like, I told Brian Chesky at some point, I was like, Brian, I've invited you on like seven times. I really am going to stop. inviting you because I feel like I offended you at some point and I really don't want to make it uncomfortable. And I said the same thing to you and you're like, Jake, I love you. I didn't do it. I'm like, so let's do a pod. It's not the end of the world. And you're it just like, really, not my thing.
Honestly, it was, I don't like to get overexposed, but it was really Gerstner. I'm really tight with Gerstner, your bestie Gerstner. And,
oh, thank you,
you know,
Brad.
Watching all you guys have so much fun on the All In, as well as how you're doing with this pod.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, you know, obviously.
I appreciate you caving. Yeah. Well, but yeah. Here's the thing. Yeah. There's, you and I have been so blessed, right? To be part of a generation that grew up with the PC, to build companies, to invest in companies, be on the board of companies. It's just such an amazing privilege. And these conversations, I have 16, 17, 18-year-olds, that 14-year-old who went to work at Microsoft, they listen to This Week in Startups, they take notes, they write me these long emails. I saw this interview, it changed my life. They come up to me, I've had people hug me and cry and say, I watched this episode with Travis and you guys talked for 3 hours, or I saw this Chris Sock episode and it changed their lives. And that's what gets me stoked every day. Think about a mission. If I can share these conversations with 250,000, 500,000 people and it just inspires 10 of them, to create something in the world, man, what a legacy and just how great it is. And you were so awesome. Let's put it on the books for a year from now. Really appreciate you taking the time. I got 1,000 more questions. There it is, folks. We'll got
save
them.
It for next time. Thanks, Jake.
All-star
Thanks, everybody.
Summer, Rich Barton.
Yep. All right. See ya.
Cheers now.